Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm over at Franklin's Farm, top of the world, and joining me is Franklin Sanders. This is the Precious Metals Market Report. Franklin, thank God. Can you possibly explain to us what is going on in precious metals?
I'm not sure anybody can explain it. I'm sure not sure I can, but I can. You know, I'd like to step back from it just a little bit and get a longer perspective on it. And I'd like to talk about midlife crises and bull markets. Most bull markets, a bull market is an uptrend that lasts 15 to 20 years. It's a persistent trend that lasts 15 to 20 years. And usually there's a midlife crisis in every bull market. There's some big gain, everybody is happy about it, and then all of a sudden there's some big collapse. And for several years, the market tries to recover. A lot of people think, well, that's the end of it. It'll never come back. But then it does come back. It gets above that previous high and generally outperforms what it did before before the midlife crisis. So this is a chart of the Dow from 1980 until 2002.
And I should stop you just to note for everybody, if you're not, go to the commentary, go to the subscriber links, and we'll have these charts up under subscriber links, so it really helps to follow along. So if you can, just click over to the commentary, open the subscriber links, and open the first chart. Okay, sorry.
So the bull market in stocks actually started in 1982, about $760. And that was in August of 82. And it climbed into October, and it got from 770 to 2750 nearly, and it just collapsed to a low of 1616. Well, it took from that October 87 41% correction to February 1991 before it finally bested that old 1987 high. But after that, it gained 7.3 times from the low. So the first leg up, it gained 3.5 times. The second leg up, it gained 7.3 times. And that's also a rule of thumb that usually that second leg up after the midlife crisis shows a greater return than the first leg up. So let's look at gold's midlife crisis. Gold started up in 1999, and from 99 to 2001, it multiplied 7.5 times. Then you got the midlife crisis. Everybody was sure that gold was going out of style. It would never come back. That bottomed in December of 2015, about 1050, then started coming back up, and it's now presenting us with one of the lowest risk buy points that it could that any market could show. Let's look at silver, and you'll see the same pattern.
I just want to point out that's the recent low is a higher low than the one before.
Right. Silver has followed basically the same pattern, except the numbers are bigger. The gain from 2001 to 2011 is 12.5 times. So it went from $4 to nearly $50. But that midlife crisis also took a bigger toll on silver because silver is a more volatile market. But again, you got the low in December of 2015, got a rise into July, and I'll talk about that in the next chart. But this is a picture of a midlife crisis that's finished. Why am I so sure that it's finished? Well, let's take a look at chart 4, which is gold for the last 15 months or so. What you see is that December 2015 low, and I don't have it pictured on this chart, but that's a kind of a bowl that gold formed there. It slung up out of that gold, out of that bowl, and went to a new high. You'd have to go long ways back to find a high that was as high as $1,377.50. That was in July. That was a new high. And then it came back and corrected. But when it corrected, the low in December of 2016 was higher than the low in 2015. So what you've got is higher lows and a higher high. That's an uptrend.
So let me pointing out a couple things on this chart, which I find interesting. I've been very worried that if we got a strong dollar, particularly if we got a bear trap rally in the dollar,
mm-hmm.
because of problems in the emerging market, that if we broke the 1100 line, it could go down to 700 and still be in a bull. And so that was my concern. And it's really held that 1100 line pretty well.
Right. Well, it's been holding on at 1200.
Right.
And that's significant because what that says is there are a bunch of buyers down there under 1200.
Right.
And every time it gets under 1200, they jump in. You couldn't have it go down to, this picture cannot be right if it goes down to $1,100. My interpretation is completely wrong if that happens.
Right. And those buyers include central banks and other governmental entities that are not inclined to run out of money.
Right.
Right.
There's some big buyers with deep pockets that,
right.
that come in. This is the silver last 16 months. And I apologize for that being such a messy chart. But first off, notice that the downtrend from April 2011, that was the old high.
Right.
Silver, gold is not, but silver has broken out over that downtrend line.
Right.
That's extremely significant. You had a low in December of 2015, traded to a higher high in July of 2016, a higher low in December of 2016. So it's come down this neckline. You had the head and shoulders here in November and December. And it's come back down through that neckline, but it's down around the 50-day moving average. So oftentimes a market that's trending up will correct that far. We're really thinking about the dollar, and let me go to chart 7, which is kind of out of order just a little bit. It's not clear to me, and you can't say finally yet, that this head and shoulders formation is real.
Right.
I mean, that's what's ruling the market. But so far you can, because you see it went up recently, early in March. It tried to break through that top of the shoulder line and failed and fell back down. So that's consistent with it forming a head and shoulders top. If it breaks that 99 point where the neckline is, then it'll fall on down to 97.5. The big question the dollar puts in my mind is it going to go up higher? Is it going to go to 106, 108?
Right.
Or is this the top? Is this the final hoorah?
Right. So here's two issues. One is, what happens if the euro comes apart? I mean, we even have the German vice chancellor admitting that could happen.
Mm. Well, if the euro comes apart, then a lot of money will go into the dollar.
Right.
But a lot of that money may go into gold, too.
Right.
So I would say the first reaction will be a rise in the dollar relative to the euro.
Right.
So, and this is the dollar index, and 57% of this dollar index is the euro dollar exchange rate.
Right.
But right now at least, that looks like a market that's fixing to drop.
So the second thing is, what about interest rates? Because if the U.S. interest rates keep trending up, that's going to be strong for the dollar, not strong for silver and gold.
It is, and I expect interest rates to go up. The thing is, it's relative interest rates as much as anything else. So what if the Europeans abandon their zero or their negative interest rate policy?
Right.
Maybe they have to.
Right.
If they have a sudden flight of out of the euro, then they'll have to abandon that policy.
Right.
So I don't, all those things are up in the air, and that's the reason why I'm careful to say this is not a foregone conclusion yet, because something like a big mess in Europe, big blow up in Europe, could drive the dollar much higher, could drive it up to 106, and that'd be tough for silver and gold.
Right, and you know, it's interesting, I asked you earlier about India and China. China just lowered their growth rates, so they only expect 6.5% this coming year. It's doesn't sound slow to me, but clearly one of the floors on the price of gold and silver has been the strong physical demand in Asia. The other thing we've seen is basically an insane cash policy in India. So the question is if Asian buying is tempered, what is that going to do?
Well, I'm not sure the Asian buying will be tempered. You know, there was talk in India of people having to report their gold holdings or having to pay tax on gold holdings. And apparently what that's done is sent a flood of people into silver. So it's been good for silver. But, you know, also there was recently a big spike in Bitcoin, and Bitcoin reached the highest level it's ever reached. Now, wait, I'm not going to say anything at all positive about Bitcoin. I promise you. That's
what the look on my face was, I've had a couple of altercations recently with people trying to market Bitcoin to me and sell me on Bitcoin, and it's so frustrating.
Well, believe me, I've heard the same story. But what was driving Bitcoin? It was the Chinese trying to get money out of the country.
Right.
That was the whole thing driving it.
Right.
So, I think the Chinese and the Indians have long time been big buyers of gold, both gold and silver. And the Chinese government is not hostile to gold the way the Indian government is.
It was, but I think it's done a
changed in the last few
changed
years.
Its tune.
So, and then finally, I have a chart 6 is this S&P. And what I'm looking at there is a big wedge that started last year. And that looks like at the top of the wedge on the right-hand side of the chart, that looks like a throwover to me, which is what happens when a market tops. But I might be dead wrong about that. It might go to 3,000.
See, I think I spent a lot of time working on the scenario designs for the annual wrap-up.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have 4 scenarios. And the scary thing is, and it's the same for the stock market as precious metals, the variability of what could happen over the next 5 to 10 years is extraordinary. Things are so fluid in terms of institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And so the variation in price of what could happen with both precious metals and the equity markets, I think, is enormous. So, for example, in the equity markets, I said in the annual wrap-up, you could see the Dow at 30,000, you could see it at 10,000.
Yeah.
Both are perfectly possible. And that's why I think it's so important in this environment to stay focused on what is real and what adds fundamental value.
Mm-hmm. But does it always pay to stay focused on that?
Here's the thing. You can jump into, you and I were talking about this earlier, you can jump into the problem is you have to know when to get out. And without insider information, it's a sucker's bet.
But, well, let me take that in a little bit different direction. Facebook. I would not buy a Facebook stock. what is Facebook?
It's a surveillance device.
It's a surveillance device.
Right.
Created by the CIA.
Right.
And why would I want stock in that? But in any event, all of that stuff, there's nothing. They don't produce anything. They don't make anything. They don't dig anything out of the ground. It's all air.
It's unnatural resources.
Unnatural resources.
They are mining unnatural resources. It's a mining operation.
Right.
It's the one author calls it surveillance capitalism. Well, the customer is not the customer, they're prey. And you're mining them. Right.
But they're prey in more than one way, and you don't want to get off onto this, but it's an addictive behavior.
Right.
It's as addictive as alcohol or drugs.
One of the things I wanted to point out, I was just up in Toronto for a week with Rob Kirby, and I was attending the Prospectors and Developers Association of Canada Spring Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched presentation after presentation, and what you're hearing is all these mining companies, the exploration budget is a third of what it was at the peak in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
All of these mining companies are going further and further into the frontier market, you know, Siberia, Peru. And so they're going further out there, taking more political risk, digging up a lot more rock to get a lot less metals.
Wow.
And it's, you know, I'm reminded of Jim Rogers at the New Orleans Gold Conference when somebody said, "Are you worried about peak oil?" He said, "Forget peak oil, it's peak everything." And what you realize just listening to presentation after presentation, no wonder they're talking about asteroid mining.
Yeah.
You know, the miners are clear. We got to go into, you know, go get the asteroids. But, you know, you listen to that and you kept thinking, the current above ground inventory is getting more valuable as I listen. And so this idea of, you know, no matter what's going on in the market, you want your core position. Because when the music, if and when the music stops, it's, you can't just go, I know the U.S. government says deep underground storage on their balance sheet, which I assume is, you know, 5,000 miles down below Nevada or something. But, you know, it's not so easy to dig this stuff out of the ground anymore.
Well, at some point, however it plays out, in whatever form the crisis plays out, the debt has got to be dealt with because the debt is too large.
Right.
It's too large to pay.
Right.
It's got to be defaulted on some way or the other. So that's in the future. I don't know when it is in the future. I look at charts and I think, oh, it's soon in the future. It's not too far out now. But the timing on that, like timing on a break in a market, is just, you know, you're dealing with human beings and you don't know always what particular catalyst will drive them over the edge.
Well, you and I, I think, differ on this because I have much more respect for the system's ability to manipulate the price.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the central banks and the leadership are perfectly happy to operate. They know how important gold and silver are. They don't care what the price is. They can operate a system without, you know, they're not worried about what the value of their holdings are, you know, because they know, especially when you're holding it in that much size. But I don't, you know, the frustration for me is it's very hard for people who are new to gold and silver to live with this kind of price volatility.
Well, and not only price volatility, but also to realize that you basically are buying the gold and silver for a discontinuous event,
right?
For a crisis,
right?
And discontinuous events, by their very nature, are discontinuous. They don't happen very often, and so you have to take that into account, and you have to learn patience that way,
yeah. Right?
But the price volatility, I know it's nerve wracking, but as I tried to show with those charts, it's positive.
Right.
It's got a positive outcome.
Well, unfortunately, if you look at the economic model, I told you I was looking at some bank stocks the other day. If you look at their fundamental economic model, it's financial fraud. They're in the financial fraud business. And so...
you say that,
right.
And I'm not sure your listeners understand that you can go through a list of all the five big banks and the zillion-dollar fines that they paid without admitting wrongdoing, right?
Right.
But over and over and over, for what? For fraudulently manipulating markets.
Well, I would tell you, in my opinion, that those were not fines.
Mm.
Those were simply commissions to the federal government for the public-private partnership. And they call it fine for political purposes, but in fact, it's a revenue sharing.
Right.
It's a profit sharing venture with the federal government because it requires both of them to do the financial fraud. So their model is financial fraud, and so they're utilities that do financial fraud, and so it's only a matter of time until they go kaboom again, and you've got to, you know, you're going to have to do a fix. So it's, you know, it could be next year, it could be 5 years, it could be 10 years. There's no way to know. What I do know is, you know, I was pretty good about getting people out of the market right before the bailouts, but this time we won't know. I don't think there's any way to know, and I've been amazed at how few insiders know. So I think this is truly, you know, we are truly moving into kind of an out-of-control multipolar world, and that's why you can't get into Yaya, because you never know when to get out.
Yeah.
One of my latest squabbles, by the way, is somebody got very mad at me for saying that Bitcoin was a fiat currency.
Well, it is.
Their idea, because it's constrained as to how many bitcoins can exist, they thought it wasn't fiat.
Of course it's fiat. Fiat's created out of nothing.
Right. And the other thing is, if you look at who your enemy is, they can simply destroy the exchange and evaporate your Bitcoins.
Which they did. They've already done on several occasions.
I know. Yeah. I know. It's, I don't know. I feel like I'm talking to bulls in heat when I...
About celibacy, right?
You know, I have a hard time explaining why they think this is real. Because if you could buy gold, why would you buy Bitcoin?
That's what I can't understand.
Right. So gold I can put in my pocket and walk away. Bitcoin I have to put in my enemy's pocket, you know?
Yeah.
So, I don't...
Well, part of it, I think, is the American romance with technology. And the assumption, the presupposition that every American has that if it's technology, it must be better.
No, but the guys I know who are pushing Bitcoin are people who think, you know, they're looking for a way to be free. So you
put your wealth into somebody else's control that you have no control over.
Right.
That's subject to government rights.
That are complete strangers.
Yeah.
And you're prototyping Mr. Global's digital currency for them. What could be more wonderful? How does that get us to freedom? I don't know. Okay, so on precious metals, I have no idea what the outlook is for the short term. But I am, you know me, I'm a great believer that the bull market will reassert. I just don't know when. And there's a lot of negative stuff going on in the horizon, and the variation is great. So to me, the question is this year going to be a good time to accumulate?
Well, I look at that the gold chart, which was chart 3, I think. I look at that gold chart, and I say, it was chart 4, and I say that's the perfect time to buy.
Right.
From an impulse wave movement, you got a move up off the low in December of 2015.
Right.
You got a new high. You came back to a higher low. That's the bottom of a two wave right there, and you started a three wave up. So right. That right there is the ideal place to buy. Of course, there's risk. There's always risk, but right. That should be an ideal place to buy.
Right, so, but don't buy anything you're not willing to hold through what could be periods of great variability.
Absolutely. Yeah, right. That's absolutely right.
Now, I showed you earlier before we started a chart of one of the defense contractors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fair to say it has significantly outperformed just about everything, including gold.
Oh, of course, yeah.
So war continues to be in a bubble. One of my favorite lines of the year was Jack Ma at Davos saying, in the last 30 years, the United States has spent $14 trillion on wars. That's because he doesn't know about the financial coup d'etat and the other missing money. That's quite a chart. We're looking at the chart of Lockheed Martin since the beginning. And you had a very interesting observation on that chart. Maybe you'd be willing to share it.
Right. Well, it looks like a chart that's almost completed its up move. It's there are three waves up, and it looks like to me that it's a chart that's in a blow-off mode. So, I mean, that at least that's technically what the chart says. But that chart also there shows that 50% of the American economy is government spending.
Right.
And it shows that there are a bunch of people up here at the top who think Trump can come in and spend enough more to raise it even higher. And he may spend it, but I'm not sure he'll raise it higher.
Well, it's very interesting because we're talking about two economies. One that's everything's run through the government and is very centrally planned and controlled. And, you know, the economy that you and I want to be part of markets is a very different economy. So that brings me... and it's very good that you're looking at this chart. That brings me to the effort to try and get a constitutional convention. Because you can imagine if you're in charge of keeping that bubble going,
mm-hmm.
you would want to tear up the Constitution too, wouldn't you?
Oh, obviously, yeah. Very much so.
Okay, so you and I had a conversation the other day about what we could do. Because what I keep saying is we have to enforce the Constitution. We don't need to change it. Besides, if we're not going to force it, why change it?
Well, one of the things that you have to bear in mind is that in 1780, 1787, when a new constitution was proposed, what happened was a group of supposedly trustworthy people met, and they ditched the system of government, which left a huge amount of power in the hands of the people in the states.
Right.
They ditched that and created a strong central government.
Right.
And Patrick Henry said of that constitution, he opposed its adoption, and he said, look, you're giving up the power of the purse and the power of the sword. There are no other powers worth having.
Right.
That's it. So he said, his actual words were, I smelt a rat. And he did. Well, if you open up the form of government to another constitutional convention, they'll do the people who've engineered that Lockheed Martin chart right there will engineer everything they want into that constitution.
Right, and let me just point out that in 2015,
mm-hmm.
The Department of Defense had undocumentable adjustments of $6.5 trillion. and immediately thereafter, Lockheed Martin, which all during this period has basically run the payment and transaction systems at the Department of Defense.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine your largest weapon maker also running your accounting systems. It's quite remarkable. But Lockheed spun that contract, that division, into another company, which tells me, despite the beauty of that position, they want the liability off their balance sheet.
Right.
Because here's the thing. If you people say, well, the money's gone. So I say, so the missing money, we have over $11 trillion that we know of undocumentable adjustments at DOD, HUD, and NASA. You can
always... $1 trillion is not an adjustment.
Right.
$1 trillion is a catastrophe. But anyway, I'm sorry.
We have outstanding debt on the official balance sheet of $20 trillion. The bailouts were $27 trillion. We can argue about how, you know, what the real number was. And then there's over $11.5 trillion missing. You know, and I could possibly take that up to 14 or 15. So we're talking about more than twice the amount of the outstanding debt being missing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's enough to retire all the mortgages in the country, make sure all the pension funds get paid, fund all the health care. Mm-hmm. In other words, this idea that there's no money and we can't afford health care, we can't afford to honor the pensions is just hooey.
Mm-hmm.
It's just hooey. But that's why they want a constitutional convention, because they want to tear up the enforcement mechanism, because you can get that money back because you can hold all of the contractors and banks who affected illegal transactions responsible.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just go through, because you and I had a great conversation. Let's talk.
Before we start, we're going to talk about our wish list.
Yeah.
But I just want to point out, the state of Tennessee in the last 2 days has filed suit against the federal government over the government forcing them to take immigrants and pay to resettle them. There's a doctrine called the anti-commandeering
right.
doctrine.
Right.
And their objection is, look, you want to do this, that's fine, but the Supreme Court has already said you can't commandeer our resources to do
right.
it. And I think that one example right there is key to why we need the Constitution we've got, because the states still have some power. If they've got enough courage to use it, they still have some power.
If I was a governor, I would increase the Attorney General's budget by a significant amount and say, your job for the next 4 years, 8 years, until we enforce the Constitution, is to sue the federal government. Take him to court and bury him.
Yeah.
Really. I absolutely would. Okay, so one of the things I've always pointed out is all of the transactions that have been affected that are illegal were transacted by the New York banks.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if we look at most state and local government, they're doing business with those banks.
Yes.
So I think it's time that the state, you know, if we want to enforce, I think it's imperative that we say, look, you banks are affecting illegal transactions, which is bankrupting the country. We refuse to do business with you. We want you out of our pension funds. We want you out of our bank accounts. They need to start holding these banks accountable at the state and local level. Why mm-hmm. can't they do that?
Well, you mean that, they can. You know, a bank is supposed to be an intermediary between savings and investment.
Right.
I mean, that's the actual logic of the reason for being for a bank, but they don't any of them do that. I mean, they go to New York and get their money.
Right.
And in other words, they feed the monster.
Right.
They're all the time feeding the monster.
So we got to get off the monster. Texas is starting a gold depository?
Yes.
We could start one too in every state. Is that not true?
The Texas bill is incredibly well designed, because what it would do would be not just to start a depository, but start a depository that where the citizens have access to it
right.
all over the state.
Right.
They don't it's not just in Austin, it's all over the state.
Right.
And there's no reason that we couldn't do that. In fact, Frank
Nicey, you've been working on it.
Frank Nicey and I were sitting in the Capitol or somewhere in the Tennessee Capitol, and he says, you know, I told them what they need to do is just burn, this is solid rock under us. We just need to burn down and put a vault down there.
Yeah.
And get the gold and put it right there in the vault in the basement. So yes, that would be that is one way to do it. But you know, we talked about a state bank owned and operated by the state, and of course the manifest problem with that is political influence. But if the state, if it could be run well, I mean, if it could be run
well, if you this kind of state bank, like if you look at North Dakota, mm-hmm. I think that's the model. But if you have a state bank that is helping build liquidity for banks within Tennessee, mm-hmm. so that they're not dependent mm-hmm. on the New York banks, what I don't want to see is a lot of government banks competing with the local banks. So what you want is you want a layer that has lending capacity at the state level and can facilitate a lot of different things that really encourages the local banks and the regional banks to get out of this New York dependency.
Right. And it is possible.
Right. And then you've got the infrastructure you need to do credit cards and payment systems that are not hackable. So now another thing is we've got to, if you have a gold depository, we still have a series of tax and other laws that get in the way of making gold and silver liquid.
Right. The worst, of course, is the sales tax.
Right.
Which, in effect, puts a monumental barrier to circulation. The second one is the federal government has chosen to say that the exclusive numeraire is the paper dollar, the bank credit dollar, really, is what it is. And so the IRS says, well, if you had $500 in gold coins,
right.
$25, $20 coins, and you sell that for paper, you've got a gain because you bought them for less paper 5 years ago. Well, that's not true at all. All you're doing is exchanging currencies.
Right.
That's all you're doing. And you're not, you know, it's not a gain. It's not a capital gain.
Right.
Why is not the dollar of silver the numeraire, because that's
right.
What the
so when I go to Switzerland
says.
And swap dollars for francs, I don't have to report a capital gain.
No.
Right.
No.
Right.
So so if you could get rid of those two taxes, those two barriers to circulation, what happens is, if people don't realize, you know, they talk about Gresham's law, bad money drives good money out of circulation. That's only true when the bad money is legally when people are legally forced to take the bad money.
Right.
The opposite works if freedom is involved.
Well, if Tennessee would accept payment of taxes in gold and silver.
Watch what happens.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and then they would have a source.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, I mentioned, we talked about the Attorney General earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Joseph Farrell's idea about basically fund the Attorney General
mm-hmm.
to start litigating with the federal government. But one of the people I would love to see the Attorney General of states litigate with is the New York Fed and the member banks
mm-hmm.
for affecting the illegal transactions. Basically say, you've affected, you know, $11 trillion of illegal transactions. Where's the money? We want it back. And our pro rata share in Tennessee is, you know, whatever. You know, I believe that there is real common law history that would argue for the common law right of offset. So
mm-hmm.
people say you can't get the money back. You can, because mm-hmm. there are different ways, both with taxes and with private credit, that we could assert common law right of offset.
Yes.
It's like, we owe you $11 trillion, you owe us $11 trillion, so you know something, we're offsetting. We don't owe you the $11 trillion.
Well, the problem with that is finding a state government that has the courage to enforce that.
Exactly.
And the fact is they're not going to put anybody in jail. The federal government's not going to put anybody in jail if the state government, the governor and the leaders of the state government say, okay, we're going to escrow all of the income tax payments here in the right. state. We're going to hold them until we get this straight with the federal government.
Right.
And that's that right of offset that you're talking
right.
about.
Right. And, you know, it doesn't have to be everything. You can still send a check for the creditors and the military. But basically say, look, we're going to reoptimize our domestic spending here. Mm-hmm. You know, so don't worry about the health care. We'll take care of it, but we'll hold back that portion of the taxes to take care of it. There, you know, there are many, many different ways of doing it, but it requires people to sit down and say, okay, so another one which is very near and dear to my heart that you've taught me a lot about is food safety regulations. Now, as soon as I bring this up with financial people, they say, food safety, what does chicken processing have to do with the suppression of the gold price? You know, I don't want to talk about food. But if you look at the economy, a lot, you know, the government has basically, the federal government has outlawed the economy.
Right.
And part of undoing that outlawing the economy means we need families to be able to generate a living or generate their own food without fear of being enforced against.
Right.
So, in fact, when it comes to enforcing the Constitution, getting the food safety laws dealt with and the, you know, the laws that stop market making around food is critical.
Absolutely.
Right.
Well, you know, the USDA inspects meat, and supposedly meat in according to their regulations, meat that's sold in, say, grocery stores, for instance, has to have a USDA inspection. Why not a Tennessee state inspection?
Right.
Why do we need them? If it's all going to be sold within Tennessee, why isn't our inspection good enough? And the, what you have to realize is here's how those regulations work. In the last 19 years, we've been through 11 or 12 meat processors.
Right.
The reason is because they keep going out of business. And they go out of business because the proprietor has sons, but they don't want to go in that business. He gets old, he retires, and they close down. Well, in order to build a new plant, you're going to have to spend more than $1 million.
Right.
Just a new processing plant. So what that means is that more and more processors disappear.
Right.
Well, there are thousands of processors out there that process deer,
right,
and you know game, and they can do just as well as the others. And go hire some inspectors if you're worried about bad meat getting into the
right
into the food chain. But there's no reason that those regulations can't be streamlined and state administered so that it
right
things can get into commerce more easily.
Right, it's remarkable. In a place like Tennessee, how if you simply re-engineered the food safety rules, how many small businesses would just sprout up immediately?
Oh, it's incredible. You know, I keep hearing and thinking about this dystopian future that people are so worried about that technology is going to kill everybody's jobs, so there'll only be 8 people left working in front of a computer somewhere in the world, and the rest of us will be drinking beer and smoking dope, right? I mean, that's the
right.
way they make it sound. Well, there's a lot of work, believe it or not, that can't be done by a computer, can't be done by a machine.
Right.
And you can take a small farm, 60 acres, 100 acres, certainly 200 acres, and you can support a lot of people off of that farm.
Right. So, but you've got to create the markets, and the markets can't happen without. One of the suggestions that we came up with was the importance of getting the local institutions to buy food, particularly the local school boards.
Right.
So if, you know, one thing I would do immediately in a state is basically say, you know, the local school boards have to buy the food from the local farmers if it's available.
Right.
And that would kickstart the market.
Oh, heavens, yes.
Incredibly.
Yeah.
Another set of laws that is near and dear to my heart is the circulation of equity.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you that it is easier to learn Russian and Chinese than it is to figure out the legal structures you need to do to circulate equity locally. So I always say, you know, I can go down to the Hickory Valley grocery store and spend my entire life savings on lottery tickets. Mm-hmm. But if I try and, you know, invest in the Hickory Valley, if I try and buy shares in the Hickory Valley grocery store, we're all going to go to jail.
Yeah, right.
You know, and they're, because they're trying to protect my capital. I can also go down the, you know, 10 miles down the road and spend my life savings on narcotics traffic. You know,
so. Well, see, once again, we've, just like regulations stand in the way of entrepreneurs, a lack of financing stays in the,
right.
way, in the way of entrepreneurs. And big banks aren't interested in financing a $100,000 or million-dollar business. They're not
right.
interested in that. There's no money in it for them.
Right, although I will say, and Tennessee has been very good. If you look at the 50 states, and we did this in the annual wrap-up, we linked to the website that shows you the underfunded liabilities for both pension funds and healthcare and debt mm-hmm. for the states. Tennessee is the second best in the mm-hmm. country. South Dakota is the best. But so Tennessee's been pretty good. But if you look at what could be done, let's say every county in Tennessee had a venture pool, so had a REIT for the county and had a venture pool for the county, and you know, and the state pension fund could invest in those.
Mm-hmm.
The state pension funds in most states would be much better off because what they've been doing is mortgage fraud. So if you look at how much you lose on, you know, mortgage fraud mm-hmm. compared to investing in the bread and butter of mm-hmm. those local markets, it's a much better investment.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say there's a way to marry the state pension fund's money with those kind of local investments that's very responsible and very reasonable. Not only that, when you make it liquid, you can make the profits of the local businesses eligible to invest in the local businesses because you've created a liquid vehicle for them to do. Mm-hmm. So the 401ks of all the local businesses, the greatest sadness I see in America is you have all the small businesses in the area pulling their capital, putting 5 or 10% of their earnings into 401ks for their employees. And by law, that money must be invested in the large companies who are trying to destroy their market, take over their business. Okay. So imagine putting 5 to 10% of your profits in a vehicle that's designed to finance your competitor to take over your market.
Right.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
So create a vehicle that allows the local businesses to circulate that in a way that's balanced and diversified, but is building up, you know, is building up their business and building alignment between the local purchasers. Because it's been proven if a consumer can buy stock in the company where they're purchasing, mm-hmm. you get a much tighter, more profitable relationship.
Right.
So anyway, so combine the equity as well. Okay. One of my favorite things about the last 60 days. And I'm sort of optimistic about the last 60 days because all solutions require transparency about real problems.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I will say about the Trump administration, we've gotten more transparency about the real problem. So it's like, it's very organic, but there's much more of an honest conversation yeah. going on. And one of the things that was stopping the honest conversation is the fake news.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to tell you, the fake news are in trouble. And it is a wonderful thing to see. But one of the things that Trump has brought transparency to is the fact that the President of the United States cannot talk to the Prime Minister of Australia without it being leaked to the press.
Yeah.
So he can't have a private conversation on a perfectly legitimate topic of national interest. You and I can't have a private conversation. Our computers aren't private. Our TVs aren't private. Our phones aren't private.
Yeah.
How are we going to run an economy in a world where, you know, you've got a bunch of telcos and intelligence agencies and internet firms basically harvesting us? I mean, we're being mined
mm-hmm.
100% all the time. So to me, one of the solutions is, can the state and local government be part of creating really you know, digital infrastructure with integrity within the state.
Secure.
Yeah.
Secure communications, yeah. Well, Why not? Why couldn't they do that?
I don't know. If they get properly capitalized with gold, it seems to me they could.
Yeah, the WikiLeaks revelations, 2 weeks ago, something like that, show that from the very beginning they've been perverting, working with manufacturers and software writers.
Right.
I don't want to name any names, but to make backdoors in so they can use every device you've got to spy on you.
Right. We just want to say hello. Well, here's the thing. You can't, as somebody who had my business harvested by the intelligence mm-hmm. agencies, I've seen the enemy of the state process work. It's very interesting. When I was up in Toronto with Rob Kirby, he basically said, he wrote an article about it. He said, look, just tell the CIA, if they can dump out the cyber warfare tools, they can dump out Community Wizard, because they've been expanding and improving it all along. Goldman's trading with it. Google's mapping with it. It's all, the data beast has been growing and morphing, and they're using it to harvest places. Let's just dump it out. We paid for it, right? It's ours. Let's dump out Community Wizard. Why make us do all the work? Let's just get our tool back.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, Rob, well, I'll certainly give permission to the CIA to dump out everything they stole from me, plus what they've been doing with taxpayers' money ever since, but why not demand it? And it's up on the website. I wrote a letter to Marshall Blackburn and said, look, it's, you want to heal the economy, it's very easy. Call in all the webmasters from all the agencies and tell them just to put up all the databases of things that are required to be publicly available, and we'll do the rest. But hasn't happened.
No.
But the administration could do it. And the attorney generals could sue and require that they do it.
Right.
Right. Okay. Anything else you want to, on our wish list to enforce the...
Well, one of the things that sounds good and is often not good is privatization of state services. And my experience with that is with private prisons. And the bottom line is that private prison wants the bottom line. And that means that they're going to skimp on services like medical services that cost money.
Right.
And I just don't... Prisons are a quintessential state function, just like armies.
Right.
Just like you don't want to go hire an army to protect you from an enemy, because those mercenaries don't have the same interest in it that you do. And I'm not any fan of state bureaucracy, of any bureaucracies, but there's some governmental functions that the state has to oversee, and that's one of them.
Right. And it's gonna be difficult. I know one of the largest private prison providers is here in Tennessee.
Oh, yes.
So that's going to be a political problem.
And, oddly enough, there are a lot of politicians that own stock in that company, too.
Yeah, they came into our county, Hardeman County, and the people some of the political figures pushing it had stock before they, and of course it all wasn't disclosed. So, but, we can hand out stock in local venture pools for communities. We can play this game, too, if we... organized. So there was one other one I wanted to mention, and that is the growth of marijuana and hemp.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at Tennessee on a per capita basis, marijuana is our number one cash crop, and we're sort of number two behind California. Mm-hmm. We're enormous in terms of marijuana. Now, my theory from what I've seen biking around Tennessee is it's all being grown on the federal lands. It's real funny. I was working out. I had a trainer who used to deal drugs over in Hardeman County, and I used to get him to sort of unpack and explain how the drug business worked around me. But he and I used to go biking together, and one time we went biking on one of the big federal parks. Well, it must have set off huge alarm bells. We got followed by troopers the whole way, and they had cars blockading the areas where you can, and I thought, how do I tell them I'm really just here to bike? I'm not interested, but it got me thinking about what's going on in the federal lands. But anyway, so, but I'm a great believer that if we could make hemp legal, it would be fantastic for local economics because there's so many different products. Marijuana, too, for medical purposes. If you look at the amount of money that's being spent around here for pharmaceuticals for pain, what the drug dealers will tell you that I've talked to around here is that their basic competition is painkillers. They're providing lower cost painkillers for people who don't have health care insurance. So,
And you know, I know, but your listeners may not, that there's an epidemic of pain pill use.
Yes.
And much of it is legal. That is, the VA and various government agencies give these people painkillers. It's especially epidemic in women over 40.
Right.
Who, you know, that reached kind of a lot of them a difficult stage in their lives, and they get addicted to painkillers.
Right.
And it's because some doctor prescribes them to them.
Right.
So.
Right. I'm very interested in the use of marijuana for juicing, for cancer treatment. So there have been really remarkable results with it. But I think if we could reduce the control on naturopathy and homeopathy and other sort of natural medicines and lift the restrictions on marijuana and hemp, you would see a real blossoming of a lot of economic activities.
I have to tell you an anecdote about that. I know a fellow who's just come back from working 4 months in California in the marijuana industry, and his job was trimming the buds for sale. You would trim the plants. They give him a big pile of plants, and you trim the plants. And he happened to mention that in the last year, the price of marijuana has fallen from $2,000 down to $1,200 a pound.
Wow.
Because everybody's going into it.
Right.
So the funny part of that is they're destroying the black market in marijuana.
Right.
I mean, because if anybody can go into it, that there's no black market to keep the price high.
Well, it's interesting. What they need is they need the tax revenues. So they're sending it over so they can get the tax revenues.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of... Well, the last thing is no, the federal government, by law, cannot spend money unless it's envisioned in appropriation. And so if your Congress critter is continuing to approve appropriations when money is being spent outside the Constitution and the government is in violation of the financial management laws, your congressman has the ability to do a huge number of things, including refusing to vote for appropriations until that system gets righted. And it's interesting. I went to a town hall meeting with a congressman who was on the budget and defense appropriation committees many years ago. And he said, I asked him, you know, I said, Congressman, this is in front of 30 of my neighbors. I said, there's $3.3 trillion missing from the Department of Defense. And he said, yes, I know. And my neighbors went into shock, like, oh, my God, she's right. So he said, yes, I know. And I said, well, what are you doing about it? And he said, nothing. There's nothing I can do. Now, this is a guy who's on the budget and the Appropriation Committee. So I followed it up with a letter to his Washington and Tennessee offices listing out all the things a congressman can do. So part of this is each one of us holding our congressmen and their staff accountable to enforce the Constitution. Or vote them out of office and get somebody who will.
Right.
I mean, you get enough people in there, get the Tea Party guys educated to this, you know, you can get this enforced. So part of the challenge with turning this around is enforcement requires thousands of actions across, you know, whether it's un-outlawing the economy, which gives us the ability to change the model, or simply holding all the institutions responsible where we can. I mean, so many people I know are still banking with the banks that have affected all these illegal transactions. Why? Why would you?
Yeah.
So it means we're going to have to hold the system accountable at the same time we change the model. And people tell me that's too hard. And my attitude is, you know, there's a great quote from Confucius, the way out is through the door. Why is it no one has availed themselves of this method? Yes, it's hard, but it's it's easier than continuing to go in the current model. We enter into an inhuman civilization, and most of us don't make it. And I don't know about you, but I'm not prepared to be a slave. The reason I know you is I know you're not prepared to be a slave. But we have a choice between slavery or freedom. And if we're going to be free, we have to be economically free.
Well, I don't know why people resist those choices. I don't know why they want to feed their enemies. I mean, it's plain to me, so I'm probably not not the person to talk to about it. I can't understand why they don't. You know, if you want to be free, that starts today. You do the things that make you a free person. And but you're right. It takes it. The problem with many Americans is they think that we can just do one thing.
Right.
If we can just elect a president, that'll change everything. It won't change very much at all.
Right.
There are millions. There, as you say, thousands of things. I interviewed a state senator, Frank Nicely, in my last newsletter.
By the way, that is a fantastic interview. Everybody should get the money changer and read that interview.
It is good. It is a good interview. Frank has a very clear mind, very conservative guy. And in 2008, the Republicans, and I'm not any Republican partisan, right, as you well know, the Republican majority got some of them got together and said, we're going to make things different. We're going to change things.
Right.
Well, they killed the inheritance tax. They're doing away with the income tax. It's got one more year, I think, to run. They've taken off all kinds of regulations. And reducing the taxes, they got $1 million surplus.
Right.
Excuse me, a billion, B-I-L-L-I-O-N, right, $1 billion surplus on about a $34 billion budget.
Right. The thing that so impressed me about that interview is you're listening to someone, and not only himself, but he's talking about a group of other legislators who are intensely interested in the real world.
Right.
And the real things you have to do to undo the outlawing of the economy. I mean, because this is trench warfare.
Yeah.
And it's complex, and it's very much in the details, particularly when you're writing law and doing legislation. But these are people who are willing to get into the machinery and start turning the nuts and bolts of the machinery, and they find that interesting.
Right.
As opposed to, let's elect the great white hope who'll go in and fix everything himself, from Washington, which is never going to happen.
Right. And this is one of the reasons why I don't know about other states. I've observed this in Tennessee over the last 30 years or more. We have some really sharp state legislators.
Yes, we do.
And you have some sharp people who are devoted to freedom.
Right.
And, I mean, I think they're a lot better than the ones up in Washington.
One of the critical reasons why I stayed in Tennessee was I was listening to a presentation by the Tennessee Firearms Association, which is I don't know if you're familiar with them, they do very good work. And the guy who was in charge of lobbying, again, a very nuts and bolts, very interested in the detail. He made a presentation. He said, the first thing you need to know about the Tennessee Firearms Association is that our membership is greater than 50% of the people who regularly vote. I said, now there's a man who is grounded and understands how to get things done. Anyway, okay, well, this has been great, Franklin. I'm left with a feeling about precious metals that you have to know what precious metals is. You have to know what it's worth. It takes people time. So for those of you who haven't gotten to know precious metals, I think it's time to learn. One of the things I realized a couple years ago, I said, okay, precious metals is here to stay, because in their model portfolio, Schwab had added 5% precious metals.
Really?
Yeah, to their model. So you know you're when you're in the Schwab allocation. But I think, with anything that's valuable, we're in a period where the price is going to vary and could vary wildly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it really behooves you to understand precious metals and to have a core position. And I do think there is a chance, and I haven't said this for many years, I think there is a good chance this year to start to accumulate if you want to take this opportunity, because I think that chart you showed us is right.
Right.
you know, we've got a high or low now, and the world is not going to get more stable. It's going to get less stable. So, I mean, I'm willing for it to get stable, but I see no signs.
No, and I think Trump is throwing a lot of the balls up in the air, right, whether he means to or not. But right, you can look at the volatility of markets since he was elected.
Right.
And it's been crazy. It's been nuts. And if you look for factual drivers of that, you won't find many factual drivers. You know, it's just basically a euphoria. And the euphoria is good. You know, the animal spirits, I guess, are good. But there's got to be some money down under there somewhere.
Right. And there are many, I would say, but the other thing I would say is inflation is very strong. It's what I'm seeing. When I was in Toronto, I said last year I thought it was 7%. Mm-hmm. It's running about 7%. When I was in Toronto, their housing market is up 20% a year for the last, 20% plus a year for the last 3 years.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, well, they got their own mortgage bubble, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do.
Well, their own real estate bubble.
Okay, well, this is going to be an interesting year. Tell us how we stay current with what you're doing.
Well, I publish a daily commentary about the silver and gold markets.
Right.
That's the only place on the internet that wholesale prices are available, because I publish wholesale prices for a large group of items every day.
Right.
And then I make my remarks about my little commentary about what's going on.
If people want to get the daily commentary,
just go to themoneychanger.com. They have to put the dash in there because The Money Changer is a porno site I have nothing to do with. themoneychanger.com. And over on the right-hand side, there's a little window that says sign up for the daily commentary.
Okay. Yeah. And then for the newsletter?
They can order the newsletter. The newsletter is paid, of course, paid right. subscription. They can order that off the website, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I read it every month, and I laugh every month. You have a way of dealing with reality that is still uplifting.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah.
So, but the Frank Nicely interview is fantastic. Okay, anything else you want to say about the outlook for precious metals?
Well, you know, I kind of had the idea. You realize it's the 17th anniversary of the last big top in the stock market, March of 2000.
Right.
And you realize that locusts come and go in a 17-year cycle, too. actually, I read a cycles analyst who makes a big deal out of 17-year cycles.
Really?
But for that reason, I've been sort of thinking some big thing would happen in this month with stocks. So I don't know whether it will or not. But that of course, will affect gold and silver.
Here's my feeling about stocks, and it bears on this, because I think a decision has been made globally to try and move the market or sort of the model from a debt model to an equity model. Mm-hmm. You know, so think about it. We have far more debt than we can afford to pay off.
Mm-hmm.
You can either write the debt down or mark the equity up.
Mm-hmm.
We have enormous amounts of cash in the bond market, you know, because we printed. It needs a place to go. And the stock market and real estate are the only places big enough. And real estate is less liquid. So the stock market is a perfect place for a lot of this money mm-hmm. to go. And I think if you look at what's been happening in the stock market, a lot of what's been driving it up is you have sovereign wealth funds, government pension funds, central banks. You know, it's like they've all gotten the commandment, thou shalt buy. and they're moving extraordinary monies in. And if you look at what's, since 2014, what's happening to the PE or the forward earnings, it doesn't make any sense until you look at the fact that you have all this cash looking for something to go. And what that says to me is inflation.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think there's an enormous strategic governance decision that says we want to manage this through equities and we want to privatize. We want to move the assets out of government into corporate hands. And I think part of this bubble we're watching is an anticipation. You know, everybody's licking their chops that they're finally going to get a hold of all this privatization stuff. So that's why I say it's very fluid and it can go either way. And I see money, you know, a lot of money chasing assets, and that could push up both precious metals and equities.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, Franklin Sanders, always a pleasure.
My pleasure.
It's always great to sit here at the top of the world. And look out, I see the sheep are making money for you as they sit and
That's
breed.
Right. That's exactly right.
You have a great day, and thank you again.